I'd like to thank the organizers. Can everyone hear me in the back? Because I have a portable one. I'd like to thank the organizers. And as Judith mentioned, there are several ways in which one can look at the establishment of asymmetries and polarity. And you can see from this particular slide, our lab is interested in the question of cell polarity and how cellular asymmetries are established in response to spatial cues. The system that we're using has to do with plants. And one particular and unique attribute of plant cells is that when these cells undergo morphogenesis, the polarity that's inherent or is imposed on these cells targeted cell wall deposition to unique areas or unique sites. For example, here, the process of cell elongation. Pardon? I'm sorry, what? Okay. The processes of cell elongation, for example, here, the polarity of these cells have actually targeted the process of cell elongation to unique regions, for example, here in tip growth. And so the polarity in the case of cell expansion directs vesicle secretion to localized regions. And also with respect to cell division, cell wall deposition and the formation of the cell plate gives rise to asymmetric divisions and sites along the cortex which establish these asymmetries. Now, if one looks at a couple of different cell types, this is exemplified here in the case of pollen tube growth, root hair initiation, where one has an apical basal polarity, and the extension or cell expansion of the root hair initial is to the basal side of this polarity in this single epidermal cell. Also, a polarity in the zygote of many higher plant embryos directs the elongation in a way and subsequent division so that the asymmetric division gives rise to two cells, each of which having different developmental fates. Here, the elongated zygote, the first asymmetric division here embedded within ovarian tissue, and the formation of a globular proembryo on this filament of cells called the suspensor, which attaches this globular embryo to the ovule wall. And again, this first asymmetric division sets up a polarity, and that asymmetric division gives rise to these different developmental fates of various cell lineages following those divisions. However, if one looks at these early stages, for example, this one here with a suspensor cell in the embryo proper, about the 8-cell stage, you see that it's difficult to manipulate this with respect to orienting these embryos with respect to external spatial cues and to understand how this initial asymmetry is first established. And so although there are many genetic approaches being used in a number of laboratories, and I'll come back to this later in the talk, to look at a genetic approach to look at these mutants early in embryo development, our approach has been to look at these early stages in a system in which one can experimentally manipulate not only the cue, but where these directionalities, that is the cell expansion and asymmetric division, are actually localized. And you can see here the development, at least to this stage, looks morphogenically very similar to what you have in higher plants. This is the embryogenic pattern in fucus embryos. This occurs free of surrounding cells. Here you have targeted elongation forming the rhizoid. The cell division or cell plate is formed here, delineating these two cells. This asymmetric division gives rise to a series of cells forming the filament or holdfast portion of the embryo. And so what we've concentrated on then is looking at this system to understand some of the early asymmetries and how they're established. Not only is this development synchronous, but one could direct these asymmetries by external gradients or external cues. You see here the directionality is imposed by a light gradient, with light coming from the upper right-hand corner of the slide, and the rhizoid or polar growth always occurring on the shaded or the side here to your lower left. So what we're interested then is, how is this axis established? How is this axis stabilized? And then what is actually directed to this site to target the process of cell elongation? And finally, what determines this plate or cell division plane in the first division of the zygote. And let me start out by saying that this stage here, although there are no distinct lines here, that there is a period of time, about the first 10 hours of development, when the axis is not irreversibly fixed. That is, the polarity is labile, and one could influence that lability with light directions from different vectors from different directions. And so one could orient light from this direction, reverse it 180 degrees, and the rhizoids would form out of the from the side of the last light. However, there comes a time, several hours, a couple of hours, before the emergence of the bud or the rhizoid, where this axis is irreversibly fixed. And what I'd like to do is to divide my talk into three topics. The first is, what's the nature of some of these first asymmetries that are established during the process of axis formation? Secondly, what do we know about what's sort of coincident with or coordinated with the process of axis fixation, the stabilization of this asymmetry? And what I'll show you is some work from our lab recently that strongly suggests that a secretory process here, which deposits material in the cell wall or extracellular matrix, is required for this stabilization. And then finally, I'll also present data that some material or positional information in the cell wall derived from this secretion has something to do with the orientation of that first cell division. Okay, with respect to the first asymmetry, some elegant work done by Lionel Jaffe a couple of decades ago and depicted here from a paper of Rich Nucitelli from his lab in 1978 indicates that one of the first asymmetries in the Fuchs zygote is the passage of current or inward directing current occurring at the presumptive site of rhizoid formation. And one of the ions that are part of this current happens to be calcium, and quite a bit of work has been done on the localization of calcium and the movement of calcium ions in this egg. A graduate student of mine, Sid Shaw, recently wanted a vital dye in which one could look at a number of these different embryos to monitor and actually define when the axis of polarity is established and how one might redirect this. And so he used a fluorescent-labeled dihydropyridine molecule, and dihydropyridine is known to bind calcium channels and to interfere with calcium channels also in plant cells. And what Sid showed with this fluorescent-labeled dihydropyridine, if light is coming from your right to the left, that very shortly after the light axis is imposed, not unlike the inward-directing current patches, that one could begin to see the localization on the shaded side. If one reversed that light during the process, during the period of polar axis formation, one can see the reverse of this, that is, this asymmetry now goes back to a symmetrical and later to an asymmetrical one, again accumulating on the shaded side. And if one does a time lapse of this redirection from one side to the other during the process of axis formation, you can see at this side the gradual accumulation of the fluorescent-labeled dihydropyridine on the new shaded side. The total amount of fluorescence in these cells remains the same, but at the presumptive site of rhizoid formation, the amount of fluorescence actually increases. So it appears then that one of the first asymmetries that we see is the rearrangement of existing plasma membrane molecules, in this case, a dihydropyridine receptor, which may in fact be indicative of various ion channels. Now this presumably forms a target site which then secretion and subsequent vesicle migration is directed towards. And what I'd like to do now is to concentrate more on the second part of the talk and actually say a little bit more about the secretion that occurs once the localization of these ion channels proceeds. And I don't have time to show this here, but in several laboratories, one has been able to detect an increase in free calcium in this region where that dihydropyridine accumulates. And also, the work of Daryl Croft and other people in our lab and Susan Brawley indicated that an F-actin patch is also localized in this region. But remember now, this is the localization that occurs during polar axis formation, which can in fact be reversed with light from a different direction. What actually stabilizes that axis? And what is the role of secretion in this process? Well, one of the markers we have for this secretion event here is toluidin blue O, which stains sulfated polysaccharide, not unlike heparin. In these brown algae, this is called fucoidin. And one could see the localization here in the secretion, still while it's a symmetrical cell, into the external or extracellular matrix or cell wall. And what we asked in this is, does this secretion coincide with the process of axis fixation or stabilization? And so what we've done, so what I've explained so far, is the formation of this target site, which can be reversed with light from a different direction, i.e. the dihydropyridine receptors. But there comes a time when you cannot reverse that. Something happens to this cell, and light from a different direction cannot reestablish that. And what we asked is, at the time at which this occurs, does this coincide with the time of secretion? And what Sid Shaw showed recently is that a couple of hours before the rhizoid actually formed, one sees the accumulation of this toluidin blue O stain at the site where the rhizoid will form, and that's coincidence with polar axis fixation. So the timing of the secretion coincides with the process of fixation. And what else Sid showed recently is by using an inhibitor of secretion in this system and in many others, Golgi-derived secretion, Rifaldin A, that the secretion here that I just showed you of the fucoidin molecule can in fact be blocked with treatment with Rifaldin A. And I'll show subsequently that this is a fairly specific inhibitor of secretion. And so now if you do this light reversal experiment in the presence of Rifaldin A, you can see that as long as Rifaldin A is present, light 2 is able to relocalize or to change the polarity. That is, the polarity remains labile as long as secretion does not occur. And you might notice here the previous work from our lab indicated that both microfilaments in the cell wall are required for this fixation to occur. And we feel now that the role of the microfilaments here is for the secretion event, because in the presence of cytochalasin, one sees the random distribution of these vesicles, the toluidin blue O is not localized, and obviously with a cell wall removed, even though the polar axis is formed, there's no place for this secretion to actually accumulate in a localized way. So we feel that these, both the coincident secretion with the process, as well as interfering with the process with Rifaldin A, indicates that the secretion is important for stabilizing the molecular asymmetries. And this just shows you that in the presence of Rifaldin A, one could begin to see, and this is continuous treatment, the localization of the dihydropyridine, the actin patch, but those in itself are not sufficient to fix the axis. One needs some secretion. This also indicates here that in the first 24 hours of Rifaldin A treatment, that cells go through a normal sequence of events, including cell division, and I'll say more about this orientation of cell division later. So it appears then that the process of axis stabilization requires a microfilament-based secretion of material into the extracellular matrix or cell wall. And our model now is to try and understand something about the genes that are localized in this region here that are involved in this secretion, as well as some possible transmembrane proteins that would link the extracellular matrix to that material. And sort of looking ahead, this is an older slide from a review by Nelson several years ago, and looking ahead to a talk by Ira Herskowitz later, you can see that polar bud formation in yeast has many of the same attributes as what we see in fucus. That is, vesicles are targeted to a site, it's microfilament dependent, and what you can see here is that many of the genes involved with this targeting, as well as the actin stabilization, are GTPases. And so one of the approaches that we've just started is to isolate GTPases from fucus, and since we don't have the ability to do mutational analysis in this system yet, what we've done is tried a couple of different approaches to try and demonstrate if this GTPase molecular switch is actually involved with the secretory events that are localized in the fucus embryo. And so three of the tools that we're using, obviously, is for immunolocalization. We're making antibodies to these recombinant proteins now, and I'll say a little bit more about the microinjection in a moment, and also the in vivo dynamics using the green fluorescent protein. Those experiments are now underway. But preliminary experiments that John Fowler has done by, who's isolated these RAC-like proteins from fucus, is the recombinant proteins with the maltose binding protein when microinjected into the fucus embryo gives very weird, not only targeted growth, but asymmetric divisions. This is an embryo that's been injected with the maltose binding protein alone. And we have a very nice control, which we're injecting at the present time, and that is that these GTPases are operating like we think they might be, then single-site mutations would keep it in an on or an off situation, and we'll be able to determine if the morphological events that we, or morphological effects of these recombinant proteins are actually due to this particular function. And then secondly, we're looking for interactors with this fucus RAC gene, because we know there are many genes that interact with these CDC42 RAC-like proteins in yeast that are involved with targeting. And this just shows that in the yeast 2 hybrid system, that the fucus RAC can in fact interact with sterol 20, a yeast gene that's involved with that signaling pathway, and we're presently isolating genes from fucus in yeast that'll help us perhaps localize other interactors. So one of the approaches then is to really see if this molecular switch with GTPases are involved with the targeted secretion. And then a genetic approach, but not using fucus, but in collaboration with David Cove, we're using moss cells, and you can see here that these haploid moss protoplasts undergo elongation, cell division, which is asymmetric, very similar to what we've seen with fucus. Light in this case is coming from your left to the right. And what we've done with David Cove is actually a paper that was published last year in development, show that many of the same properties of the fucus system can be done with these haploid cells, which are amenable to mutational analysis. And so if we look, for example, at setting the polar axis with that diagram, you can see that the axis, light coming from your left to right, the axis of symmetry is set in the proper orientation, but in this particular light regime, most of the protonema, the extended cells, are extended portions of these protoplasts are coming from the light side of this axis, so the polarity is actually just reversed. But we could do quite a bit with light orientation here. In fact, David has recently shown that the axis of symmetry here with respect to light, or the axis of orientation with respect to light, occurs independently of the polarity. And with different light regimes, we could actually get the polarity to come out either towards light or away from light. And a mutational analysis is now being done on the system to help us with a complementary approach. And not only can you transform moss, but recent evidence suggests that you could do homologous recombination. And if we have some target genes in fucus or other higher plants, we might be able to get the moss homologs and knock those particular genes out with respect to these processes. So the final topic I'd like to talk about now is what are the processes, or what are the requirements to orient this first cell division. And in an oral presentation later, Cheryl Bisgrove from Daryl Cross Lab will say more about the actual nuclear rotation that occurs in fucus at the time of the cell division. But as many of you probably noticed, and I referred to earlier, that in the presence of Rafeldin A, one of the real surprises that we got was that the cells went on and divided at about the same time, but the cell division plane was in fact random. It was not oriented perpendicular to light. And this is the nuclear rotation that occurs, that I'll just have all of you go to S40 and hear about it from Cheryl Bisgrove. But what Sid did was that in those experiments earlier, those were continual treatments with Rafeldin A. What he designed here was a series of pulse experiments in which he said, at the time the cell division site is being determined, what effect does blocking secretion have? Or what effect does preventing some kind of positional information getting into the cell wall have on orienting that division? And does that division that occurs randomly, does that division affect the polarity when one resumes secretion in this pulse? And again, we found a big surprise. And just notice here on the left-hand side, sort of the untreated cells. Over here on your right, just concentrate for a moment on these first two. This is a quick washout, or a short treatment with Rifaldin A, and then washed out at this point. Notice that the target site accumulates at the right site in the presence of Rifaldin A. Division plane occurs randomly. And if that division plane occurs in such a way as it does not interfere with that site, secretion resumes after Rifaldin A treatment at the proper site, and one gets a normal-looking polar embryo. The cell division plane is abnormal, but we always notice the rhizoids coming from the shaded side. So clearly, by misorienting that division plane, that target site and ultimately secretion is not altered, and that site remains. Hence, the polarity appears to be independent of the plane of cell division. But if that cell division plane actually bisects that target site, either with an early washout or a late washout, what we found was in about 40 or 50% of the cases, these bipolar embryos. And you can see here that these bipolar embryos, either with an early washout or a late washout, are indicative then of this plate interfering or actually making two target sites, that once the Rifaldin A is washed out, secretion resumes, but now two target sites. And what I think these results tell us is that not only is there something in the wall that's important for orienting that division plane, but clearly the polarity is not dependent upon that division plane being oriented in a proper way. Always the rhizoids come out the shaded side, completely independent of that plane of cell division. And what we think happens then is that at the time of secretion, some kind of information is localized in this region, which is important for orienting that nuclear rotation and that division plane. And that once this cell wall material is deposited here, that we believe that that kind of information may also be important in terms of cell fate determination of the rhizoid and thallus cells. And just to conclude, those Rifaldin A experiments then, we feel that that secretion of the wall fixes or stabilizes that axis, that it's required for polar growth and the proper orientation, and that it's critical also for the patterning of the early embryo, and it appears to be independent of that first cell division. Now, I don't have much time, but I wanted to at least alert you to some very nice work done by Colin Brownlee in the UK that has to do with this particular component here. We've already showed that something in the cortical region is signaling back with respect to polar growth and cell division orientation. What Colin's experiments have shown over the last couple years is there's something in the cell wall that may be having a role in determining either rhizoid or thallus-like properties. Now, again, this is the toluidin bluo staining that we've talked about with respect to the initial secretion, but if we look at a isolated extracellular matrix or extracellular or cell wall ghost of this embryo, we see that this asymmetry is maintained even in the two-celled embryo. And what Colin actually showed with a series of laser ablations is that cell walls can act, this here, a rhizoid cell wall, if cells from the thallus region come in contact with that wall, those cells tend to be more rhizoid-like, and cells coming in contact with the thallus wall tend to be more thallus-like. And so that collaboration is going on not only with the Brownlee lab, but with the a lab in Roscoff, France, Bernard Clareg, to begin to understand the molecular basis of this and to understand a little bit more about what genes might be involved in the extracellular matrix. We did some work several years ago showing that an epitope that's found in vitronectin, human vitronectin, is localized in the extracellular matrix of fucus. We know now that that epitope is probably the heparin binding domain or the basic regions of human vitronectin. As I mentioned to you, fucoidin, the sulfated polysaccharide in fucus, is very similar to heparin in many of its properties. And so the question is, can we get out a gene that might have some of these properties? And I'm going to change this to the Vichaus-like protein after the last couple of talks, because this is a 6KB message. It has no relationship, no similarity with anything in anybody's database or the extensive ESTs in plants. But what it does have is three basic domains And these basic domains have very similar properties as that in human vitronectin that binds heparin. And in fact, antibody to this recombinant protein is localized in the extracellular matrix of fucus with this immunoglobulin staining. And we also know the fusion protein of this gene from fucus not only can be recognized by various antibodies to that region, but also binds not only heparin, but fucoidin. So we believe that at least one of the proteins that's localized in this extracellular matrix is this particular protein, a fucoidin binding protein, and whether or not this has any role in either fate determination or polar axis fixation is clearly unknown at this point. We do know this has a role in adhesion because this antibody prevents these embryos from sticking, and indirectly that will affect the subsequent morphogenesis. Now, I mentioned earlier that the pattern of early embryogenesis in fucus resembles that of Arabidopsis. And you can see here that fucus is on the top. A schematic of Arabidopsis is down here on the bottom. And we've concentrated pretty much up to this stage. And what I'd like to do now is to at least begin to bridge this gap between what we're looking at in fucus and what's being observed in higher plants. And our approach in the next several years is to see if these two different systems can come together and give us some complementary information. And so we noticed in fucus that there's localized material in the cell wall that may have a role in some of these morphogenetic processes. And we've also noticed that in Rifaldin A-treated embryos, that these embryos appear to maintain a polarity in the absence of oriented divisions. And so one particular study in higher plant embryos, this is a multicellular embryo from Brassica, stained with all cell walls. And you can see the suspensor cell and the embryo proper. And what you see here is a stain with a monoclonal antibody to a plasma membrane epitope that stains just the cells of this suspensor, but not the cells of the embryo proper. So clearly there are epitopes that are localized in lineage of these cells of the suspensor, not unlike what we've demonstrated with the vitronectin-like clone, as well as the toluidin blue O staining in fucus. And then finally, due to the work of several laboratories, most notably Gerd Jurgens in Tübingen, one of the mutations, here's the wild type in Arabidopsis here on your left, and right next to this is the mutant called FASS, F-A-S-S. And you can see early on that the FAS mutant has very weird division planes and very abnormal ones, yet the polarity of this embryo remains. And in fact, seedlings of FAS have all of the body types of the Arabidopsis seedling. This is the wild type. It's a lot shorter. And so even though this FAS mutant in Arabidopsis has abnormal division planes early, the polarity is maintained. And we're trying to sort of see whether or not this phenotype is very similar to what we observe with Rifaldin A. And several of these genes, the Nolle gene, which is another mutation in early embryogenesis, and the known mutant, both have domains in those proteins that are potentially related to secretion. So what I tried to show you then in this 30-minute presentation is that by studying this experimental system here in fucus, that we can, due to some of the earlier work done in a number of laboratories, including Lionel Jaffe's lab, begin to see these molecular asymmetries now with vital markers, and perhaps begin to put together the signaling pathway between light perception and the asymmetry. And then both of these last two points that I wanted to make is that secretion and directed secretion to a particular spot appears to be intimately involved with setting this asymmetry, establishing the polar axis, and then this preliminary work of ours suggesting that something in the cell wall or cortical regions are important for orienting that first cell division. And just to thank three of the people that did most of the work I talked about today, this is Sid Shaw, a graduate student who did the work with Rifaldin A and dihydropyridine. John Fowler is doing the microinjection and the rack work, and Crispin Taylor has been involved with cloning these extracellular matrix proteins and has done a heroic effort in sequencing and trying to understand what these proteins might do. And then finally, we've had close collaboration with a number of labs, including some of my colleagues at UNC, John Pringle and Keith Burridge and Ted Salmon, and the Clareg lab in France, and David Cove, also in Fucus, and David Cove's lab in Leeds. We have a continuing collaboration with to take a more genetic approach with moss to look at some of these early events. Thank you again for the organizers and for your attention. Did that happen on purpose?